Good afternoon. Welcome back to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Well, our guest this hour is the new governor of the state of Minnesota. Jesse Ventura was officially sworn in yesterday. Today he is spending his first full day as Minnesota's 38th or 37th governor, depends on how you count. This morning he held a reception for Minnesota legislators. This noon, it's your turn to talk with the governor, so we sure invite you to give us a call. Our Twin City area number, 651-227-6000. Time to get used to the new area codes, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Governor, thanks for coming in today.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be here today. My pleasure.
Now, I haven't seen you for a couple of months.
Since you predicted my victory here.
Well, actually, it was right after you won, so I was on. I did go out on a limb then. Now, okay. You look the same. Do you feel the same now that you're the official governor?
Yeah, I really do. It's I can't change who I am. I've got to stay the same person. It's the old thing. You do what brought you here. And so I'm going to stay the same person, probably wear suits a little more than I'd care to. But then again, I can dress the way I want to now. I don't have to seek re-election or do any of that. So jeans and T-shirt might be the uniform of the day at a few times here, too, also, because I'm very comfortable that way with tennis shoes and jeans and T-shirt.
How did it feel yesterday to take the official oath? I mean, after all this long buildup and all the surprises of the year, and finally yesterday you raised your hand.
Actually, it was a relief because it's been so hectic from November 3rd, where truly your life gets turned upside down, even beyond what I believed it could. You know, the night that I won and became the governor-elect. And from that point on, it's been 12 to 14-hour work days, you know, at the Capitol, dealing with commissions, budgets, appointments, getting acclimated, going out to the different departments, meeting the department heads and all that. So it really was almost a relief to go there and now officially be doing what I should be doing. And, you know, I'm going to throw it out because you know how I am. Hypothetically here, if we can for a moment, if either of my two opponents had won, all during that transition, they would have been paid. Mm-hmm. Attorney General, Mayor. They would have continued to collect public salaries, and I guarantee you they couldn't have done their jobs because I just finished this transition period, and it was 12 to 14 hours of focused every day at doing the transition. And again, it's the unlevel playing field to the person in the private sector. I'm unpaid from November 3rd till yesterday. And yet, if either of my opponents had won, they would have been paid for their work. Not really their work. They'd have been paid for what they used to do, just like what I complained about during the election.
Mm-hmm. Why do you suppose there's been so much interest in your inauguration after the initial shock of November 3rd? I could understand that, but goodness gracious, reporters everywhere, everybody's all agog.
Well, I think it's the fact that I came out of nowhere. No one gave me a chance, if you want to call it the typical Rocky Balboa story, where, you know, they knew I wouldn't quit. They knew I'd give it my all. But no one gave me a chance. All the quote-unquote experts were wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think that the underdog story always plays well with the press and the media because it gives them something to get their teeth into, and it gives them a great story, and so they've been capitalizing on it. And I think beyond that too, Gary, is the fact that we had the highest voter turnout in the United States, which we can be very proud of here in Minnesota. Still not up to snuff as far as I'm concerned. It could be even higher. And second of all, we brought in so many disenchanted voters, people who had left the system, who had given up on it, as well as, even more than that, this big number of young people. The young people came out and voted in Minnesota more than any other place in the country. So I think it's that phenomena a little bit that has the media very much, and all parts of the world. Japan and all over the world are looking at this because as many countries face apathy, all of a sudden here's Minnesota And that we don't have any lack of apathy going on here right now.
You mentioned that yesterday during your inaugural address, talked about young people, keeping them involved. How do you do that? I mean, once all the hoopla dies down a little bit and you go back to a fairly routine existence as governor and the legislative process.
You think so?
Well,
you think I can be routine?
Well, we'll see.
We'll find out.
How do you maintain that level of interest?
Well, you of course won't maintain it to the peak level that it was prior to the election and the novelty of it and all that. But we had a meeting, and I talked about this in my address. We brought in 13 citizens across the state of Minnesota that were randomly picked, but not randomly picked. They weren't picked just if they voted for me. That wasn't what we were looking for. Mm-hmm. Tell us why you voted for Jesse Ventura. No, we brought them in. They were either first-time voters or they were people who hadn't voted in 5 consecutive elections. And we brought them in and asked them the question, how do we keep you involved? And their answers were very clear, honesty. And I think in light of what we're watching in Washington today, that is a very big word called being honest. And when they say honest, they were very clear, too, in saying this doesn't mean we want you to tell us necessarily what we want to hear. Mm-hmm. We just want you to be truthful. And another thing was brought out, how they were alienated. They said it's the same thing. Every 4 years, the politicians come out. They give you all this hoorah stuff that you listen to all the way till they get elected. They said then you don't hear another thing about it until 4 years later when they bring up the exact same things again over and over and over again. And they said, we're tired of it. We're tired of it.
Lots of callers on the line here, but before we get to our first, I have to ask you one more question. What in the world does "huya" mean?
Huya?
Yeah.
That's a greeting. That's a greeting, an inner circle greeting of all Navy frogmen and Navy SEALs in the Special Forces Navy community. If an instructor like Chief Moy, who was there yesterday, if he were to drop me for push-ups, the only way I can get recovered and stop doing them and get back to my feet is when I've done whatever the required amount happens to be. I have to give him a hoo-yah, Instructor Moy. And unless that's hoo-yah is accompanied, I'll still be down there doing push-ups. So it's a word, it's a made-up word that maybe it's part of Jesse speak now, and it'll probably become traditional here in Minnesota. But that's where it comes from.
But just to clarify, so you'd be doing, like, say you do your 100 push-ups, and when you got to 100, then you'd yell "Huya."
Huya, Instructor Moy.
And if he didn't yell "Huya" back, he
would go recover, dummy. And you'd be back on your feet. He doesn't "Huya" you back.
Oh,
because you're a trainee. You're a tadpole. You're not a frog, man.
"Huya" goes up, doesn't come back down.
That's right. Pretty much.
Governor Jesse Ventura is our guest this hour. Jessica, your question for the governor, please.
Hi, Jesse. I have a serious question for you.
Hi, Jessica.
I got to give you a little background first. I'm 20 years old, and in 1998, I married the man of my dreams and had a baby, and we bought our first home. And now my husband works as a full-time program coordinator for a developmentally disabled home, and he makes $8.50 an hour, and he doesn't get any insurance. For us to get insurance for our family, it would cost about $60 less than our mortgage that we pay for our home. Mm-hmm. And recently we took our daughter to the doctor because she was constipated. And they said, oh, bring her in. So we took her in, and he charged us $80 to tell us not to feed her rice, apples, or bananas for about a week. And later, after we paid the bill, we got a thing in the mail saying that they would waive any money that our insurance company didn't pay that we would owe. And that kind of made me mad because it said that they would have taken $60 for something we paid $80 for. And basically, my question is this. I'd like to know why, I know you're kind of against social programs, why wouldn't you support, given our situation, us getting on Minnesota Care or a program that could help us out for a year until my husband, who has a degree in biology, can get a job that maybe will offer us some insurance and make it a little less money for us every month.
Well, I sympathize with you, but again, you have to remember government cannot always be there. Government is not your parent. You know, in decisions you make in life, you have to be able to stand up and accept the responsibility of those decisions and career moves, family planning, and things of all that nature. You make those decisions, and certainly I support government being there to help the people that need the help. But I also want the people to understand that they need to stand on their own two feet, and they cannot just be dependent upon government. And what people need to clearly understand is this, and I've said it during the campaign, and I guess obviously I need to continue to say it. Government doesn't create $1 of money. When government gives somebody money, they took that money from someone else. So always remember, if you're receiving something from the government took that from someone else to give to you.
Minnesota Care Program, would you like to see it continued as it is now? Or
I'm not an expert on it. I certainly I think that there has to be a safety net out there. But I also believe in competition. And I believe that in the healthcare industry, by socializing medicine, it might be a good Band-Aid temporarily. But in the long run, I think it's going to be a major detriment, as it is to me, in socializing a lot of things. Competition pushes prices down, not socializing and monopolizing.
Mm-hmm. Wally, your question, please.
Yes, gentlemen, I'm honored that you'll take my call today. Mr. Ventura, I'm a member of the Highway 55 protest reroute people.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And my question to you, sir, is if they were to show you, if our people, the Midwaukee and Dakota people, were to show the state officials new evidence about the reroute and the destruction that's happening down there with the Highway 55, would you, sir, look into the matter? Would you be willing to look into the matter and help the Mendota Midwaukeeton people, as well as Earth First, keep the reroute out of there to save the sacred spring and our sacred trees?
Keep him on the line.
Okay.
I don't want him cut off.
All right.
First of all, where were you 30 years ago?
30 years ago, sir, I was 10 years old, sir.
Well, my point is this. I lived in the neighborhood and went to Roosevelt High School. 30 years ago, they took down and cleared out Hiawatha Avenue. And these homes that were there, if it's sacred land, why wasn't it protested and made aware that these homes were sitting on sacred land 30 years ago?
That's a good question, sir, that I can't answer, but I
well,
can't
I think
tell you,
you need
that
to,
Elder...
Well, wait. Now, I think you need to find me that answer, because it seems to me all of this sacred stuff started about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
And my point is, what's the difference if a house sits on sacred land or a road or highway does?
I understand your point, sir. My comment to you would be that I don't have that information. The elders that I've spoken to have told me that that is sacred land, and I believe them. And my question would be, would you be willing, sir, to sit down and speak to the elders in the Midwaukeeton Dakota community about that area?
I certainly would entertain the thought of speaking with them, but before I do, they better answer the questions I just asked you.
And I'm,
because the other thing is this, we've also been told about these sacred trees that are supposedly 100, 200 years old, and yet scientifically the trees are not that old. So it's impossible for them to be as old as they're being stated as being.
Well, scientifically, they did not take any core samples of those four specific trees that we're trying to protect. So their information saying that those trees cannot be that old is not scientific, because they didn't take any core samples.
Well, if they take a core sample from it, won't it hurt the tree?
That I'm not sure, sir. I'm not a botanist.
And neither am I. But that's what I'm being told by botanists, that they're not as old as what they're being claimed to be. And again, my statement is, why wasn't there protest over the houses being built on this sacred land?
Is there any way, Governor, to... without
or supposed sacred land.
Without reopening the whole Hiawatha Avenue, is there any kind of middle ground here? Any way to protect what some people view as parkland, sacred land, and still get the road straightened out and get all of that taken care of?
I'm not an engineer. The engineers have worked with it. This supposed spring is not being touched. You know, this cold water spring, that's protected. Nothing is going to harm that. It's just a jag over with the road. And I have a hard time dealing with this, because then what happens anywhere? Do groups come forward everywhere and call every land we have sacred land? I mean, who deems what's sacred?
Mm-hmm.
What's sacred to one is not sacred to another. And as I said, you know, where was the protesting while all these homes sat on this supposed sacred land for all these years? There were people living there with homes built on this land. Well, if it was sacred, you know, why? Why wasn't there protests going on 30, 40 years ago over why these homes were allowed to be built there?
Mm-hmm. Eric, your question, please.
Yes, Mr. Governor. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, Eric.
I'm a veteran of the United States Navy. I'm a gunner's mate, mm-hmm. still in the reserves. And I'm also an avid hunter and shooter. What I worry about today in this state is gun control, amongst many other more important things. But I feel that where do we stop with this new act to do a criminal check on rifles and shotguns, as well as as well as handguns?
Well, gun control is not a small thing, because it's protected by our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. So it was a large enough issue that the forefathers of the country saw it as that. I believe that we have the right to bear arms. I've always believed that the Constitution, Bill of Rights, gives us that right, and I will continue to work for that. But by the same token, we need to keep guns out of the hands of people who have given up their right to bear arms, and those are criminals. But for law-abiding citizens, I'm a firm believer, as a law-abiding citizen, you have every right to bear arms, and they're not just there for hunting and fishing.
Any specific changes you see that you're going to push in terms of state gun laws?
I'm not going to push anything, and a lot of it is federal now today anyway, and I think the current restrictions we have now are plenty. We're overregulated already, and all we have to do is enforce the laws that we have on the books right now, and they'll work just fine. And people need to remember something. Guns truly don't kill anybody. It's the person that pulls the trigger. You know, that's like blaming an automobile. If someone goes out and gets drunk and jumps in a Ford, and I'm just using that as an example, which I have to clarify those things now, Gary, you got to be real careful. But if he jumps into a truck or a car, whatever make or model, Ford, Chevy, whatever it might be, and he's consumed alcohol, and he goes out and kills somebody, drunk driving, do we then blame the companies that build the cars? Absolutely not. That would be ridiculous. So by the same thought process, you can't blame the guns for the acts that stupid humans do. Let's blame the humans. Let's put the blame where it belongs, on the person that pulls the trigger, not the particular instrument that they use to cause the destruction with.
You mentioned DWI. Are you going to support lowering the legal drinking age, or drinking limit, I should say?
Well, my view on that is lowering it from 0.10 to 0.08, it looks good politically. But it's not those people that are killing people out on the roads. It's the people. We need to get tougher drunk driving laws for repeat offenders. These people that time in and time out continue to get drunk, they get caught 8 times. Well, how many times do they really do it? 150, 200? These are just the times they've been caught. We need to get tougher and be like Europe. That's a privilege to drive an automobile. And we need to start saying, this is not a right. This is a privilege that's granted to you. And we need to enforce that when someone loses that privilege, they lose it very severely, because there's no excuse anymore. There's no one on the planet or in the United States of America that doesn't know that if you consume alcohol, you should not get behind the wheel of a car. And we need to be tough. To me, it's not so much on moving 0.02 of a decimal point in there, or whatever it is. It's the fact that when someone gets popped, and it's the person that's up about 1.3, 1.4 and higher, that when they get it, that they're dealt with very severely and critically.
Mm-hmm. Rose, Rosemarie, your question for the governor.
Thank you. Hi, Mr. Ventura, Governor Ventura.
Hi, Rose.
My concern for the state is the crisis and the shortage of affordable housing. I'm not one of those people who's real worried at all about getting a tax rebate. I know there's a lot out there who are, but I guess I'd be more excited about seeing some of the money from our state go into housing. There's so many people out there who are, you know, working lots of jobs, working real hard, and there's so very little choices where people can live anymore, people who are not wealthy. I'm wondering how you feel about that. I know you're one of your priorities is education and taxes and stuff, and education and housing are so closely tied together, you know, with kids having to move all the time and the mobility and the non-stability. What do you think about investing more in housing in the state?
Well, what we need to do is make it attractive for the private sector to do that. The people that build the homes. You know, you've got all the private sector builders out there that earn a living, and they go according to what the market dictates. We have to make it attractive for that marketplace to be in low-income housing. And again, rather than simply making another government program or taking more government money to subsidize things, why not lower taxes? Why not do it from that side of it and make it cost-effective for the builder to build that type of house? If we can make that happen, they will build them then. But you have to make the market has to be a thing that is attractive to the private sector. You cannot just sit and flush money into government programs and government building of everything. Certainly, you look at it to a certain point. But then again, if we allow the government to grow and grow and grow and get larger and larger and larger, who foots the bill for the government then?
Mm-hmm.
You gotta indulge the private sector and make it attractive for them to build those houses. When that happens, those houses will get built, and that's our job as government, is to make it attractive for the private sector to do that.
Tax rebates, tax cuts, what can we expect?
Well, you can expect surplus money's coming back.
All of it?
Yes, absolutely. It's surplus.
How's
that's
that?
Above and beyond what was budgeted for the government to operate on. The only thing, all the hoopla came on this over when. Because apparently the legislature, if they've got a few quarters in their pockets, they got to spend them. I don't have that problem, Gary. I mean, I can, whether I give it back immediately or give it back June 30th, I can wait. My point is I want to create policy here. A policy, and I call it again, KISS, keep it simple and stupid. Because people out there in the world, they don't have time to be watchdogging us. They don't have time to be looking over their shoulder. They're busy raising families, going to work, doing what they got to do to survive out there. And by keeping it simple and stupid, if they know that biannually, every June 30th is the end of the fiscal biannual budget, and that's when you balance the checkbook. And if there's a surplus of money, you then know, wow, this is when we'll get it back.
Mm-hmm.
If it's there. And that's all I want to do is create a policy. Not we're going to get a little bit back here in February, and then again we'll give some back in July, and then again in December and all of that. Well, people need to remember it costs money to give money back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it becomes expensive to return that money in whatever way that you're going to do it. And so that's all I'm trying to do right now. They're going to get all the surplus money back because I believe very strongly that's what the legislature's there to do, and that's what I'm there to do is create a budget. When we bring in more revenue than what that budget is, that revenue should go back to the people that put it in there, and the same as any utility company. If they charge you $100 for your electric bill when in reality you should have only paid, you know, $70, well, then you've got $30 coming back on that electric bill. Plain and simple.
Republicans will argue, though, that, you know, the basic point, as long as there is money in the bank, people will come up with legitimate good programs to spend it on. And then, of course, the rebate will...
Well, then there's a simple thing. It's called no. And do we need, and this isn't like getting a second definition of is. I don't think we have to worry that there's only one definition of no. And if they want to pass the bill to get it out of the mix right away so that they can't do that, I'm fine with that. I have no problem if they want to make that the first thing that they do. No problem. But I just want to create, again, policy to where it'll come back June 30th, the end of the fiscal year.
Tobacco money, are you going to lump that into what's considered the surplus?
No, I'm separating that because the tobacco money is the result of a court case. That's not the result. The tobacco money is not the result of overtaxation or surplus budget money. This is court case money. And yes, we could give a one-time give back of that money, that lump sum. It'd come out to about $140 for everybody, roughly, you know, in that general vicinity. But I think this is money that was won through a court case. And I think we can help humanity a lot more by doing some other things with that. One thing I want to do with some of that tobacco money is create a trust or an endowment that will earn money from years to come. And with that earned money that it earns off the principal, I would like to take that money that it earns and put it into health research, both at the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic. Because I think here you've got tobacco that has harmed so many people. Well, let's turn this money into a positive for humanity. Let's turn it into a positive to where we can do research to help conquer things like diabetes, how we can help conquer things like AIDS and diseases out there that help us as a society a lot more. I think, in my personal opinion, I would rather see my money go for that than I would a one-time rebate check that I can, go out and spend $150 on something. You know, down the long haul, I would prefer to have the research done to whereas if I were to come in contact or wife, family, relatives, friends come in contact or be, you know, have something like diabetes to know that we've got, you know, research going on to help conquer something like that. And I think that's a more humanitarian thing to do with it.